And now the technology is hot and is used by some junkies from some country. And there are plenty of those junkies. Plenty using it, no cosine, no nothing. It's like give a monkey a machine gun. And what the monkey is gonna do with it. And then we have a Russian government. The problem here is that in every autocracy, we're not talking about the politics, but we need, in terms of the technicality of that satellite, to mention that. In every autocracy, whether you have a right and you have a constitution, if there is a government or government body, they can violate anything they want and they are not punished. Nobody can do nothing about them. So Russians start to jam and put Russian poetry or some Russian music, classical music on it, so the other Russian cannot use it and put their dirty language that they use there. I'm not talking that the Russian language is dirty. I'm talking that they use a very much dirty language there, so cannot communicate because they are in fear that somebody could use that as a white, nationwide Russian opposition. So we're talking about they are afraid that if it becomes popular, so it might be used for something that they cannot control. So they spend money like in after the Second World War and in the 80s, there was Radio Free Europe and Radio America. That was heavily jumped by Russians, using plenty of energy and plenty of transmitters because they didn't want Russian and other countries under their occupation to listen to the free word from free country, United States of America. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, I mean, that's the nature of any tyranny, that you have to keep out the truth. And, you know, so you set up your own propaganda mills. You know, it's been done, you know, as long as there's been any media. They did that with radios back in World War II. I think broadcast radio technology, was not as ubiquitous during World War One, because I don't particularly recall too much of that going on for World War One. You know, in World War Two, amateur radio operators, most likely no one listening tonight was around for it, but the government came by and they either took guys' transmitters or they unplugged them and put a seal around the cord so that if you broke cord, you broke the seal, they could put you in jail. They were very, very concerned that spies might transmit information through one of those amateur radios and such. So, you know, this is what governments unfortunately do. You know, there's a playbook someplace, apparently. You know, it wasn't particularly written by Machiavelli, but it's very Machiavellian. And one thing you do is you control all the public information byways. You shut down the internet, you shut down the radios, you shut down the TVs, you close the newspapers, and then you're the only source of truth in that country. And that brings you to lovely places like North Korea.
That is absolutely right. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy, for your words in here. Low frequency operation is 630 meters, 220 meters. So we're talking about 472 to 479 kilohertz with 5 watts ERP. Actually, if the audience would be able to give the difference between PEP and ERP. So what is the difference? You're not Dr. Roy, please comment on it. What is the difference between PEP and ERP?
Okay, PEP is peak envelope power. It's the total amount of energy that your transmitter is putting out. ERP is the effective radio power, which is the amount of energy that the actual antenna is turning into radio waves.
Right, so with ERP you can have a 5 kilowatt of power turning into 1 watt of power. Let's say, right or wrong?
Yeah, it's basically a way of expressing efficiency. You can have a very inefficient antenna where you throw in a lot of watts of power, 99.99% is being turned into waste heat, and 0.0001 is being turned into radio waves. But, you know, if it's sufficient amount of radiated power and propagation conditions are favorable, you could still use practically any power transmitter to reach someplace.
Golden words. Thank you very much for that. You can reach someplace. Right. So, in the history of 630 meters, the Meritan calling distress frequencies from 415 to 495 kilohertz since 1906. They were using it, the automated satellites, the GPS, ended that frequency range CW operation. HAMS began experimenting with in 2006 with 23 stations licensed by the FCC to do it. So for those who are interested, it is not that we have a band we can apply if there is a window for it to be present in the new area, but the only need is to get to be willing to go to that window. So now we have 5 watts of ERP. So 63 HAMS held 630 meters experimental license prior to the FCC approval, but the FCC knew about it and they could do it legally. In March 30th, 2017, the 630 meters at 472 to 479 kilohertz at 5 watts ERP. Thank you, Dr. Roy, for explaining that. Became available at 220 meters from frequency 135.7 to 137.8 at 1 watt ERP. So it doesn't matter if you put 5 kilowatts, 50 kilowatts, or whatever the power you put. The important thing is that ERP is 1 watt. And that has some sense in that situation. The lower is the frequency, the less information you could put into the signal of this frequency. And I'm just thinking that if you have 2.4 kilohertz bandwidth for a single side band, and you're operating at frequency, let's say, 1 kilohertz, it is impossible to have that bandwidth. So that sort of would explain why, when the lower frequency, the less information that transmission contains. Maybe Dr. Roy could use better words. Back to you.
Hey, Suki, yes. We kind of talked about this either last week or the week before. The concept of symbol rate, that, you know, physics makes you pay a price for things. So if you transmit a unmodulated carrier, effectively you have a negligible bandwidth of the signal. As you put more information in it by modifying the sine wave, breaking it up either with Morse code or some digital modulation or you know, amplitude modulation or frequency modulation, you disrupt the classical sine wave into complex waves that translate into a wider bandwidth. So the more symbol rate, the higher the symbol rate, the more data you're transmitting. If you were to use CW and go with, you know, one word per minute, bandwidth would be narrower than if you transmitted a message going at 30 words per minute. And that's the underlying principle of the limitations, one of the many limitations of ultra-low frequencies, is because the band is narrow to begin with, the available bandwidth of any single signal kind of limits your symbol rate, and that's why, for the most part, I don't think any of these guys use any voice modulation. They're operating either digitally or just good old the first digital signal CW.
And then we're talking about misconceptions, let's say 630 meters, which used to be pretty heavily occupied by harmonics from the AM radio stations, and now is available for ham radio amateurs. And because the power that is allowed is very low, also in 2200 meters, which is 136 to 137 kilohertz, there was the fear of the regulators, which is FCC, or power companies, the PLC systems that were used to monitor the high voltage electrical power that is going through the high voltage transmission lines from point A to point B, and allowing us to have electricity right now at home and talk, using that electricity. That because those systems, the PLC system, were using the carrier of the frequency 150 kilohertz, then working at 137 kilohertz might be something with a high power, might be something that would affect those PLC systems. The problem is that this technology is almost a dinosaur. They use fiber optics right now, but the regulations don't want to speed up with that. Dr. Roy.
Well, that's the problem with regulations and such. Since they're written on paper and ink, and it takes about 10, 20 years to get regulations written, and then when they're meaningless, it takes another 20 years to have them removed. We all kind of know that general coverage radios, by law, have a filter in them for the frequencies that used to be used by the analog cell phone frequencies, which disappeared decades ago, but the law still remains and the radios are still blocked for those. So, again, that's the nature of regulations. They tend to be very slow in coming and very slow in leaving as well.
Okay, and now you have misconceptions about 630 meters. One of them is 7 kilohertz is too narrow, and QRM is too great. And that is misconception. Would you mind to comment on it, Dr. Roy?
I'm not sure if QRM is particularly feared that much. I would assume people would have a lot more problems with, you know, lightning static production. You know, it would be more QR Nancy, I think, than QR Mary. But, you know, I mean, it's a limited bandwidth. I mean, you know, if someone announced a new HF band for amateur radio operators, and handed them that smaller slice of the RF band, you know, most amateur radio operators wouldn't even consider, you know, modifying an old radio to pick it up. It just wouldn't be that worth it. It's still primarily for experimenters. And, you know, I find it endlessly amusing that the name that they call themselves are loafers. So it's guys who are really captivated with the idea of ultra-low frequencies. I don't see a incredibly great use for the technology, but then that's what the Navy thought of the entire HF range. That's why they gave it to us, because they thought it was worthless. Now, back in the old days, it was the Navy that ran frequency allocations because of history of ocean-going ships and such.
Okay, another misconception about 630 meters. Newham band. I will be not heard without an amplifier. Talking about the Sotapotec guys and QRT guys. Dr. Roy, please formulate your comment.
Well, again, it depends upon the parameters. In the right circumstances, you don't need an amplifier. If you want to extend the circumstances, then an amplifier would be nice. In general, I don't think anyone should really consider it as a day-to-day dependable transmission technology. You know, I mean, the Navy did for submarines for many years, but they had a lot of money to spend on inefficient antennas. So, you know, they were able to get away with murder.
Okay. Another misconception, N2HGN. I live on the postage stamp on effective antenna, and effective antenna is impossible. Well, mostly we're talking about quarter wave antennas. How about 10,000 of the wavelength antenna? It still work. Any efficiency? Okay, Dr. Rick, please comment on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on how inefficient you think you can get away with. You know, if your receiver is 3 inches away, you could probably make it, you know, 0.00000000001% efficient. Again, it depends on the environment.
Okay, another misconception. There is no amateur equipment available to transmit on 630 meters. If you were to construct contradicting answer to that misconception, how would you do it, Dr. Wood?
Can you say that again, Wesley?
Okay, so you have some misconception about 630 meters, and some statement is that there is no amateur equipment available to transmit on 630 meters. And my question was, if you were to create an answer that is opposite, that is trying to prove that it is not like that, how would you do it? And to exceed it.
I'm not quite sure what the question is. How would I build a transmitter?
No, the statement says that there is no amateur equipment available to transmit on 630 meters. But let's say you are obligated to say that there is an equipment, and there is a way to make equipment, and there is a way to go around. How would you do it?
Well, it's not very usual, but people to this day still build transmitters, so it's probably not impossible to build your own, or you might be able to pick up some naval surplus. I don't know whether that type of technology is available on naval surplus, but it might. You know, if there's a will, there's a way. I mean, you know, there's nothing special about ultra-low frequencies. You just need to set the oscillator at a very low frequency. That's all.
That is correct. As far as the transmitting part, you take a signal generator that you can buy in Hamfest for $5 or $50 or $20. You tune to the frequency of 630 meters that is legal for ham radio operators. And you take an amplifier that you usually use at 160 meters and just make the coil in it to resonate also an additional band, which is 630 meters. What's a big deal? Americans could do it if they want. They only need to want. They need to have that something that actually makes them act. But when they start to act, they make America great again without any additional help of any fat guy. And to exceed you. Okay, let's go to the next one. Okay, in March 30th, 2017, we've got 630 meters that could be used by anybody, anywhere. So again, it's 5 watts, 220 meters, which is 135.7 to 137.8 gigahertz, 1 watt ERP. And, of course, you have to be 1 kilometer, which is almost 1 mile, less than 1 mile, 70% or 5% of the mile away from PLC. And the PLC was that network that was used to monitor power lines, high voltage power lines. That doesn't exist anymore. Mostly is removed because now they use a fiber optic for it. But this is the regulation. What it says is UTC approval. Oh yeah, because this is for the Europe as well. Required no mobile operation allowed. 500 watt PEP limit. Safety consideration. I have no idea what they talked about. Okay, if you have any comment, Dr. Roy, I'll talk to you.
Not really.
Okay, the next one, communication through the air using military technology of the past. It was a do-it-yourself project to show communication is possible through the air. This method was used to a limited extent during the World War II. It is a simple method and can be implemented using a simple component. If you try this, you have any questions, of course, I would appreciate your comments. And imagine that you have a regular amplifier, stereo or mono amplifier. Regular amplifier that you use for the music. And you put the microphone into it, and you could hear the voice in the speakers. But now you're taking speakers out. You don't want it. You put some wire into the terminals where the speaker used to be. And at the end of that wire, you put two electrodes, which are simply pieces of fiber, copper rod. And you put it deep 3 feet into the ground. And you keep the distance between those electrodes about 15 feet. Now you created a transmitter that is able to communicate through the air. And that method was used in World War I, then in World War II. And that leads to interesting information about the telephone. The telephone, as we know today, we're not talking about the modern telephone, about the IP telephone, but we're talking about the regular telephone, copper line. At that time, didn't have two wires. It had one wire. So in the war time, there was one wire that was run to the telephone set in the front line. The commander was at the rear, and the other wire was the air that was used for it. So it was the beginning of the one wire and the return air communication telephone. So now imagine that you have soldiers in the World War One having a headset, regular headset. That is a high impedance, that's a 2,000 ohm or 20,000 ohm. And those two wires from the headset is connected to two rods on the front line. And he's able to, 2 to 10 miles away, able to hear the guy, the commander, talking to this low frequency amplifier, audio amplifier, and giving them the command. Isn't that amazing, Dr. Roy?
Yeah, it's amazing, and you're quite true. The first telephones did operate with an earth ground, but very quickly everyone kind of figured out that that was going to suck if they had to keep doing that, and it didn't last very long. There was a lot of interference, there was a lot of noise, and you know, it was limited range. Just by adding a second wire, life was much easier, so... It's an interesting footnote to technology, but, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to go back to using an earth ground for my telephone.
Okay, so that is interesting, and during the World War II, British found that they could over-listen Germans using such a telephone system. In their telephone system that was made exactly the same. So they could actually copy and relay the information from the German language about the enemy movement and whatever the comments they've got. And there was an interesting comment also. So I'm going to read this comment. I was field wireman in the U.S. Army. We train on two-wire system to connect four independent phones to switchboard using different patterns and ground for a turn and for sending signals that were hooked to old switchboards. And that was the 18th Engineer Brigade in 1970. We used 22 of them. And then... He's talking about using a teletype line machine that was used by the troops, American troops, at that time. So, for many of us, 1970 was like yesterday, or was like a few days ago. And how much technology changed from that time? Let me drop. And then another comment. During the Cold War, an agent, CIA, let's say, was found apparently fishing in a Swiss lake. And it turned out he was communicating with a colleague through the lake, from the other side of the lake, using an audio amplifier whose antenna was a fishing line made of wire, not nylon. So, of course, American people, guys who likes fishing, didn't use it, at least I didn't hear that they use it. But in Europe, especially in Russia, where nothing is allowed. So whatever you do is not allowed. So what's the difference, what not allowed you do? The Russians were using the same method to communicate around the lake, to let somebody know that the cops are coming to check how much of the fish they already fished today. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
AC2GS. So you got to keep in mind, the Russians are very, very good about letting their citizens drink vodka.
Yeah, that is correct. So we're talking about, if I say the country of alcoholics, that would be too much, so I cannot say the country of alcoholics. So let's say I have imaginary country of alcoholics, where being sober is something, it is something. That would be my expression. Dr. Roy.
Well, I don't have to, I don't want to cast aspersions. There are a lot of cultures that occasionally are used as examples that have a higher incidence of alcoholism than other cultures. Vodka is just basically, if you think about Russia, I don't know of anyone who doesn't kind of pair the two concepts together. The water of life, I think they call it.
I thought it was a funny thing when I was, Georgia, Europe. Georgia is in Europe, beautiful country, small country, was a part of Soviet Union before it collapsed. And in 2011, I went to Georgia, and the reason was a scientific research whatsoever. And I wanted to see the antenna that was a coil that was winded clockwise and counterclockwise that would resonate at 10,000 of the wavelength. And talking about the VLF or LF. And the guy that I visited looked normal. He was constantly drunk. He was an alcoholic, which was nothing special because everybody there was using alcohol. And if you can recall from the history file, we're not allowed to talk politics, but the history files is history files. Okay, Stalin in Russia was a horrible person. And he's accused of murdering millions. So we're not talking thousands of millions. We're talking about 10 million, 20 million of their own. Imagine. He was an alcoholic too. But when I went there, everybody was drinking, but they didn't look like they got drunk. So, that guy was able to drink a bottle of vodka, of Russian vodka, and I didn't see him drunk. I could touch that vodka, just a touch, just smell it, and I got drunk. So I asked, what could you give me a wine? But my head is not used to alcohol, so I was very cautious about it. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, it's my understanding that Stalin was probably Georgian to begin with. If you drink enough alcohol, it does one of two things. It either kills you, or it kind of causes your liver to enlarge and actually to work harder. So chronic alcoholics, before they die of cirrhosis of the liver, can sometimes hide it reasonably well. There are a lot of famous actors who, after they shuffle off this mortal coil, you start to hear all the stories of how they spent half their time getting drunk in bars and having bar fights. The whole generation of English and Irish actors had that history, from Richard Harris on. But they could, if they had to, they could act sober because their liver at one point or another before it teetered and failed, was highly effective at getting rid of the alcohol in their system.
Yeah, and to make sure. So yes, I admit I was drunk one in my time. I mean, I didn't feel like I was drunk. I noticed I didn't have to have any other scientists around me or somebody who is making the expertise, but I noticed I'm not able to walk straight. And it was strange. It was I could say, if I could study that, but then I could not study that because the head is not able to process. And then I found out that alcohol is preventing me from being concentrated. It is more for relax, and I didn't want it to relax, because relax is relax is a comfort. I didn't want to have a comfort. I wanted to be to use my time constructively. So I became. I love alcohol. I love it. But I cannot drink. That's my 5 cents. Just to wait.
Okay, different strokes for different folks. I drink on occasion. It's very rare lately for whatever reason. I don't like to get drunk because I like to be in control of myself. So I usually don't. When I was a much younger, more foolish young man, I occasionally went beyond a point where I shouldn't have, but, you know, nothing serious happened, and I pulled back from that, certainly. But, you know, it's sort of a shame. It destroys people's lives, destroys families, it destroys all kinds of things. You know, it's sort of a shame that our biology kind of lets us get away with it.
Yeah, but I believe similar to me, when the rabbi gives you this many shevich and everybody's watching at you and you drink it and you are not used to alcohol, shortly after that, because there's a big chunk of Manishevich there in the shul, in the synagogue. Shortly after that, I always felt like, wow, that was something, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring this up because I felt it might be a little bit inside baseball, if you will, but the old guys would love to, the hell with the Manischewitz, they tried to get me drunk on scotch, Kiddush for Shabbos and such. When I was 19 years old, my father passed away. So, you know, I was going to shul to say Kiddush for him for 11 months. So one of the hobbies the old guys had was to see if they could get the 19-year-old stinking drunk. So, you know, he kept on pushing shots of scotch on me. Fortunately, I guess genetically, my liver was rather good at detoxifying it because I never really had a hangover or felt drunk at all, you know, after consuming a couple of shots of scotch. But these guys wouldn't go for Manischewitz.
Yeah, so plenty of good memories for two Jewish guys. They are proud of being Jewish, like me and Dr. Roy. But anyhow, it's a history that's a personal family history and memories. We live on the memories as long as we can. And talking about the favorite subject, one of the favorite subjects of Dr. Roy, artificial intelligence, I sent him the video, and the video had a phrase, and that phrase, actually the video was about the Chinese progress, the kind of guys imagine how far they went in stealing our stuff and doing their own because they already can. So they're feeding us with junk because we likely buy the junk for a few dollars. They're making money on it, but for themselves, if they really want those robots, those dogs, those soldiers, military soldiers that soon may replace the regular soldier, they made it absolutely amazing. Let me drop. And there was a quote in that video, and I was caught by that, and I would love to Roy to comment on it, because this is of AI, because we think AI, but not everybody say, what the heck is that AI? I mean, how is it going to affect? What do I need that? Can I cook it? Can I make a spaghetti out of it? And then I'm reading the quote. And it doesn't matter if the AI is evil or conscious. If you are chased by the heat-seeking missile, you don't care if it has goals in a deep philosophical sense. Dr. Red.
Hey, C2GS. Well, I understand the concept, but, you know, it kind of breaks down into two separate things. You know, effective weapons are dangerous things for your enemies to have. So in this case, either real AI or fake AI or amoral AI, you know, is sort of a meaningless concept. The fear that's usually presented of AI going rogue is not that it's being used by an enemy human, but it's being our entire control system is being taken away from all humans, and you know ultimately a artificial intelligence being makes the decisions. So you know instead of just having fellow humans that happen to be Chinese using technology against us, we now have a being that is not human anymore. That probably scares people a lot more than even the Chinese.
Yeah, but do you think that Moore's law still apply to the progress?
No, Moore's law has been fudged for at least 10 years. It's not doubled every what, 18 months or something. Most of the chip density is kind of being built up on layers. They're not shrinking the dies because you can really shrink the dies much more than they've been shrunk. You know, with quantum mechanics, I hate to scare people with quantum mechanics, but, you know, if you build a transistor small enough, the electrons can tunnel right through them and not work like a solid-state device. So we're approaching a point where you can't just shrink the die for each individual transistor on the silicon. You either have to change the medium or stack them in three dimensions. But Moore's law has been kind of a philosophy in the last 10 years than an actual pseudo law.
Interesting. Well, I have a little different approach to this subject because we take millimicro, nano, pico, femto, atom. Those are the prefixes. So micrometer, millimeter, micrometer, or millifarad, microfarad, nanofarad, picofarad, whatsoever. So then we're talking about 1 nanometer, which one of my electron microscopes able actually to put 4 nanometers, but you could see 1 nanometer scale. You cannot see the atoms. You need below 1 nanometer to see a row of the atoms, so it looks like a very nice row of balls. But if you have a not a material that is made from one kind of atoms, but there are different atoms of different species. Let's say aluminium and gold present, then you are able, by your eye, looking at the raw of the atom, to see that this is not one material, right? So creating a transistor that is as small as less than nanometer, we are far away from that, and we are not able to do that yet. So I don't think that your comment applies yet, and to Asia.
Roy, may I interject a question here, please?
Sure.
Is artificial intelligence rational or irrational?
It's neither, unfortunately, because it's not real intelligence. The use of the term intelligence is a misnomer. The closest analogy that I could offer you is it's an incredibly sophisticated sentence autocomplete algorithm with a massive database behind it. It calculates the probability, given the initial words that you put into the beginning of it, to kind of predict the most likely string of words thereafter. So it doesn't have a consciousness. It's neither good nor evil. It's neither rational nor irrational, although I guess you could say that since it's not real intelligence, it might be closer to irrational. It's given to hallucinations, because sometimes if you give it a starting sentence that doesn't really fit with any probability, it'll go off and make stuff up.
That sounds pretty rational to me.
Well, no, I wouldn't call that rational, though. It's a computer program, you know. I mean, would you call a calculator a rational device? I mean, it gives you rational answers, I guess, but there's no consciousness behind it to either be rational or irrational.
Well, it also may be an extension of the TV concept where it becomes like an idiot box.
Maybe. Brian, you wanted to say something?
Good evening, everyone. This is KF2ZZ, Brian. Hi, Roy. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing okay. A little bit of laryngitis, but I'm getting over that now. No, I just wanted to let you know that I'm here and I'm listening.
Oh, okay, Brian. Anyway, getting back to your comment, I tend to disagree with you. Although fabricators call things 4-nanometer technology, they're sort of fudging with that 4 nanometers. A single silicon atom takes up about a fifth of a nanometer, give or take. And you need a row of them, again, because you can't just kind of line up 3 or 4 silicon. Have to have a dopant, so and the dopant has to be a low percentage of the material. So just by definition, you have to have a significant number of silicon atoms to be able to minutely dope them so they're P and they're N regions. And if you build them too short, like I said before, unfortunately, the shorter the barrier, the more likely electron tunneling occurs that will produce random effects. So people, you know, Intel is about to go next to bankrupt because of their inability to shrink their dies. TSMC is working in ultraviolet contrast mask printing. So they're running crazy trying to figure out how to improve these chips. I mean, all they're really doing now is building multi-layer chips and stacking processors next to each other and building architectures with high-capacity processors and much more lower capacity processors and controllers that shift the work to the most efficient processor on the chip. So they're expending billions of dollars trying to get around the expectations of everyone. So I tend to disagree with you.
Dr. Roy, I love your disagreement. This is the best you could do for me. Always criticize because it is the key to the progress. Personal progress, business progress, any progress is efficiency. You have a comfort. Nobody criticizes you. You have everything that you want. Even if you are minimalist in life like I am, some people would prefer Latina music, which is making people smile, music, right? Beach and some nice, beautiful ladies and doing nothing. Because life is beautiful. Okay, so, you know. I love your skepticism and it shows in my deficiencies. It shows me that I need to work on myself. It gives me a drive in life also into the next science project or the next something that is interesting. Many people have a sclerosis, whatever the problem with the memory they have is because they don't trade it. I'm not saying about heavy medical problems, but not trained too. It's not necessarily working the same way in the trained hand, like a trained hold tool. I'm trying to make some sort of humoristic answer from the Dr. Roy.
Well, yeah, I like to keep up to date with new technology and how people are kind of getting around a whole bunch of inherent limitations. Recently, I don't know if you keep an eye on the density of information carrying capacity of hard drives. They're starting to sell multi-platter HDs that are capable of something like 24 and 28 terabytes. And they have to kind of the laws of physics. In order to record in such a small surface area, you have to preheat the area with a laser beam. So they've designed hard drives that not only have magnetic heads to read and write, but they have lasers that are pinpoint that preheat the area as they record, because they can't record in lower densities at ambient temperatures. So, I mean, all these, there's loads of other technological tricks that they're playing for semiconductor production. It's very difficult to make a high-end semiconductor. TSMC in Taiwan is the only guys that really produce the at proper yield, the latest, greatest silicon. That's kind of why we invested billions of dollars in having them put a factory in the United States, you know, just in case something wonky happens in Taiwan. So, you know, it's fascinating to me how people are kind of bending the rules and getting away with things, not breaking physics entirely. But, you know, don't just assume that the things are happening in straight lines. Straight lines are one of the cognitive problems human beings have. We tend to kind of assume that things will go in the same direction as they have for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And if you ever look at long-range graphs, there's always a point where everything goes wonky. So I keep abreast of technology and when it fails us. And one of the things that's failed us is Moore's Law. It was a real thing back in the early 2000s. But, you know, over the last few years, they've really fudged every kind of description of how Moore's Law is not really following what it was set up to be back in the good old days. But, you know, it's going at a very fast rate nevertheless. I've mentioned before, battery technology, ran as fast as solid-state technology, you probably would have a battery that lasted years that was the size of the head of a pin.
Comment?
Certainly.
Moore's law has not been, in my opinion, has not been relevant for over 15 years. The processors that are produced by AMD and Intel, more so by Intel, have been incremental at best, very, very slow. The processors that have been produced like GPUs and things that they use for data mining, AI from NVIDIA are superbly more advanced, but not for the computing desktop.
Yeah, I agree with you, Brian. I mentioned some part of that earlier in this little discussion. It's unfortunate. Intel has had a load of bad news. Intel was kind of the first guys to say that they were going to put out a 5 gigahertz CPU, and it overheated, and so they had to go back on it, and that's when they decided to just build multi-cores rather than faster speeds. And they announced that they were shrinking the die, and they were going to move from nanometers to something smaller, and that was a disaster. So I agree with you. It hasn't followed. They've kind of fudged and redefined Moore's law as much as they possibly could to make people feel happy. But Moore's law, which was never really a law, it was just, you know, a happenstance. The guy made a prediction, and it worked out for a good number of years, but eventually reach a technological limitation. So I agree with you, Brian.
The progress in personal computing technology has been unbelievably slow, and a lot of it has to depend on heat dissipation and power and space. And the real strides are being made, like I said, in the GPU end, where everything is being offloaded for not only for graphics, but for processing of algorithms and, such as that. So, there has to be a very, very big change. Otherwise, things are going to be plainly stagnant. Now, to Apple's credit, their processors, which they've designed, have a little bit more oomph to them. But even then, it's going to follow the same kind of, end.
Yeah, again, I agree. There's a lot of research being done on using different technologies, building diamond bases to improve thermal dissipation, trying to think of other semiconductors instead of silicon that might have some benefit in changing the characteristics. But I think they're reaching a problematic point in graphic processing units. They keep on selling boards that melt their power cords. That's not a good sign.
No, it isn't. The problem is basically the how should I say this? The other peripheral areas, are so fast right now that they way exceed the capacity of the CPU to go ahead and supply the data. They vastly outstrip, for example, the PCI bus. They can't even implement the fast version because the CPUs are not fast enough to keep up with it. Everything is behind. Even memory as well. It all has slowed down. You need to go ahead and rethink the technology and work on new designs.
Well, I'm sure hundreds of billions of dollars is being spent doing just that because, you know, we're hitting walls, the least of which is electron tunneling. You can only make a